This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So, welcome to this week's podcast, Urban Political Podcast. Our theme for today is a little bit different. Having talked about lots of the politics and spatiality of the COVID-19 situation, today we're going to focus on how the situation is affecting teaching and learning within the discipline of urban studies and more generally within universities. We have two guests, Robin Chang from the Technical University of Dortmund and Meg Holden from Simon Fraser University. So to get us started, could you just generally introduce yourselves? We know where you're from, but tell us a little about you, about your work, your fields of specialization, perhaps starting with you, Robin.
Sure, yeah, I can kick us off. So I'm a PhD researcher based at the Department of European Planning Cultures here in Dortmund, and I've been working since about 2015-2016 on my PhD here, looking at temporary and adaptive uses. I'm a Canadian who's been based in Germany since 2012. So I have been educated and also practiced planning in Canada, in BC. And my interests have been, in my research, have been inspired by experiences working in the professional fields of dealing with temporary use permits and permitting processes.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Ross and Marcus. Very happy to be part of this podcast. My name's Meg Holden. I am currently the director of the Urban Studies Program at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. And I am part of I'm a professor of urban studies as well as geography there. I have a background in planning, pragmatic philosophy, and sustainable cities research. And so my body of work is about really how to get people to experience the city differently and to develop attachments to the city that are sufficient to change behaviors and habits in order to motivate more sustainably oriented and justice oriented behaviors.
How can we characterize these challenges in short, medium, long-term ranges, and how can we best think about them in terms of things that we can handle and develop solutions to?
So that's a great question, and something that I think a lot of instructors as well as researchers might be going through right now. I can speak to my experiences with the students so far, as well as what's happening in within our institution. Some of the short-term challenges that we've definitely encountered are those that are more infrastructural, and what I mean by that is hard as well, soft. So hard in terms of internet access, so having the actual space or access to technology for online learning as the physical distancing restrictions have now come into being. And then also softer infrastructural issues such as access to software as well as the learning tools that we need. So within our faculty as well as our university, it's become clear that we were not ready for dealing with COVID-19 and teaching in the wake of COVID-19, because we just did not have the access to all the tools and the software. In addition to that, there's so trying to adjust to that. We've also had some inequities revealed in terms of what students can afford to have some of these technologies and tools at home. So other colleagues of mine have basically come to realize that some of their students might live at home without necessarily adequate Wi-Fi connection to be able to facilitate Zoom or web conference meetings or online learning, mass learning opportunities or formats, because they only had mobile devices with data. So the German data plans that they have here are a lot more restricted and more expensive than, say, the Canadian ones. So not everybody has the luxury of that immediate access to this type of infrastructure. Some of the students were also very highly reliant on access to library as well as campus Wi-Fi. So these inequities about how do we adjust to these students, or how do we make it easier for them to be able to access the tools that they need to learn, and how do we facilitate that was definitely something that was important. And also the procurement of all of the necessary licenses for all the applications, the software applications required for tools, or the setting up of VPN networks and connections so that we could at least facilitate these connections for them. I think this is still a consistent challenge for us at this point. So I know that a lot of our students who work with geographical information systems are still not sure as to how exactly within the next semester they will be able to consistently access the labs, the computer labs that they might need for their spatial plans. And then on top of that, you have this issue of capacity training. So I was lucky in that I had colleagues my colleague that I was working with, we were already pretty fluent with Confluence, which is the tool that we're using, but there are other teachers and instructors and colleagues who don't necessarily have those skills. So knowing which tools are appropriate for what type of format, how to actually use them. So we've witnessed a huge swell of tutorials and online resources made available for these colleagues, but it has been a very steep learning curve, and no doubt this is not something that's restricted to us, but I can imagine that for a lot of institutions and instructors who haven't had to use online and virtual learning environments, within the past month, basically month or month and a half, they've had to make themselves aware of what the tools are and how they work. And so you have this very steep mainstreaming of all these tools. And now, of course, there's in our institution the question of how long will this go for. So we know that the next semester will be online and digital as well. But what are the more medium, I guess, and long-term impacts coming out of this? These are some questions that we still have to more seriously consider.
That's a really good summary, probably internationally in universities and colleges around the world, of the kinds of stresses and strains and steep learning curves that Robin mentions that students and educators have experienced. The longer term prospects that you just asked about, that's where I return to my questions about experience and what kinds of experiences students and then ultimately educators too do and don't have access to. So Ross, before this podcast, we had a bit of an exchange around the paper that was published by Isabel Angulovsky and Catalan colleagues in Barcelona, proposing an ethics of care emerging in academic praxis in the post-COVID era. And I wonder, I think that care, of course, you know, is the primary concern now. But in a longer term, what happens when we don't have the experiences that we have had the benefit of in the past, let's say, 5 years, 10 years, when the experience of learning, either in a classroom with our colleagues and our classmates who challenge us, you know, in a physical way as well as an intellectual way, because we're sharing the same space, we're sharing the same air, we're sharing the same airtime, and then the experiential learning more phenomenologically when we're out there in the city actually experiencing the rush of traffic, experiencing the frustration of transit that doesn't work or crowded sidewalks, experiencing the smell of engineering structures and pollutants and gardens. And so I wonder about the notion of an ethic of experience when we are sort of submitting to this new era of accepting that because we can't protect the sanitary nature of our students' environment in the classroom. Therefore, we shouldn't subject them to the experience of being in the classroom with one another, let alone all of the complications now that have been introduced and that are going to plague the very idea of doing experiential learning out in the city or in an international context, certainly.
Indeed, yeah. And to some extent, Meg, you and I, we had tried to, along with a few other colleagues and our students, Christian Lemke, as well as Rebecca Gunnarsson, capture this in some of our written work and look at how a notion of discomfort zones or these formats that encouraged or created opportunities and spaces for students to look at these encounters of that risk kind of the comfortable surroundings of the standard classroom for this more real life and experienced type of learning and what it meant in terms of not only providing them with these sensory impressions, but then also this more emotional and probably more personal experience of understanding that there are limitations to their understandings and the way that they see the world, but that this can be, we can help them approach these boundaries, and we can also help them adjust these boundaries in understanding the world and understanding the realities of a kilometer of subsidence, or that there's height that is associated with highway connectivity. And this is something that we found really important because it is a notion that accompanies a lot of uncertainty that happens in urban studies, urban planning. I mean, the purpose of, or kind of the principles behind urban planning for sure is looking at how to manage and to prepare for uncertainty in future scenarios. And now we're being forced to confront this in a different light with the uncertainties of how do we do this in the classroom setting as well. And what are the right questions to ask so that we can think, we can be more thoughtful in not only addressing and responding, but maybe creating the legacies for a better learning and teaching environment with specific fields that relate to urban studies specifically.
And just picking up on that, moving forward, do we... what kind of opportunities do we witness, do we see against this background?
So Robin and I were talking about a couple of different strategies that we have seen or that we are pursuing in the immediate. So I had a field school that was canceled this summer. We were intending to go to Helsinki, and that course is still going ahead, believe it or not, in a mostly virtual format. So we will have guest lectures from Helsinki, virtual visits and those kinds of things. And some language. We're lucky enough to have some language speakers as well. But we're also insisting on sending students out on their own to travel in the city of Vancouver to designated sites that have Finnish history or that illustrate something else about some of the notions of the Nordic version of urban sustainability and resilience that we're discussing. It's a sad kind of thing to send students out by themselves for an experience that really should be much richer. It should be immersive in a foreign, in a strange environment that is unaccustomed, that doesn't have those sort of comforts of home. It should be the experience of community with other students who are also similarly put off balance and in this unknown context so that they can have the experience of working through that discomfort and those problems together, which are aspects of the learning that we're losing out on. But nonetheless, it does preserve that experiential element of learning, which is so powerful. And I think just important in the medium term context of recognizing that not all learning happens within these nice rectangular bounds of an electronic device and what it shows.
So I'd be curious if you could reflect on your pedagogical insights in the current moment, also in view of what this means with respect to marginalized population and the approach of planning towards a very diverse and a social environment. I remember working with an homeless-led organization in New York City. We always had the impression that, especially the planning profession, was kind of planning over our heads, and there was very little interactions in terms of drawing out the expertise of homeless people themselves. So I guess I'm looking at this notion of experience that you have expanded on, and try to insert here the question of, okay, how is it possible to allow for an experience of planners that is interactive with their social environment, with the diversity of stakeholders that are involved in planning, and how is that going to be incorporated at the current moment in the planning, in the teaching of urban design and planning?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. Let me take a stab at it. One of the things that happens when you're taking students out into the field, into the city, and attempting to learn from different experiential learning environments is that you have the opportunity to encounter people who would never set foot on a university campus. Why? Because it's intimidating. And even, you know, my university campus is, we're actually downtown Vancouver, right near Waterfront Station. It's an extreme, and it's right on the border of the, on the border, it's not a border, but right on the edge of the downtown East Side neighborhood, which is a neighborhood of deeply entrenched poverty. We have an open door policy. And while to me that seems open enough, we have certainly expectations that people will not be prevented from coming into the university. And yet there are still barriers that make people who have never had the experience of university learning, let alone participation in a planning process, open up to them. And so by going out into the neighborhoods, students are able to, and planners are able to experience that gap in a way that probably never would have really sunk in without that visceral experience of just how excluded people who are on this, sharing the same sidewalk as you, or the same park or the same alleyway, might be. And by learning practices of respectful interaction, we can come to understand empathy for different groups, and we can understand the different perspectives that especially poor and marginalized people have on the impacts of planning. So one of the things that seems to be coming up in this sort of immediate rush for urban responses to a COVID recovery are related to urban design and the physical redesign of spaces. And some of these things are exciting because for planners, because they point to some of the things that planners have been trying to push in cities for a number of years, like car-free streets, like opportunities for seating and outdoor patio spaces being expanded into the public realm and into parks, spreading out pedestrian and bicycling options. Well, those things are certainly part of a sustainable cities agenda, but if that effort is pursued because of a public health demand that we maintain 6 feet distance from one another at all times, and in a context in which community engagement principles have been suspended because it's presumed to be unsanitary and not in the interests of public health to engage people in the expansive way that we now demand in cities like Vancouver, then that work is being done to the detriment of the people who depend on those spaces because they have nowhere else to go. And so that's very troubling. And there needs to be not just that, and there needs to be the experience of coming into encounter with poor and marginalized populations in order for planners to understand that. There needs to be the opportunity for poor and marginalized people to engage in the planning in a way that is not considered to be unsafe and unsanitary. And there needs to be a way to welcome poor and marginalized people into the conversation about what the solutions are to cities in this post, well, we're not in the post-COVID era yet, but in this response to the pandemic too.
Yeah, I can only also support that as well. Bringing this back to more recent experiences with the students, and the group that I had never really interacted nor had the chance to be introduced to what an Aboriginal culture or heritage looked like, or who that was. And that was their first chance really during our time in Vancouver to meet with educators or urban agricultural activists, as well as other students who had that exposure or could represent that type of diversity and a very different narrative of inequality that they just have no access to here in Germany. And so I also do find that very worrisome, because the world of learning, as well as how we sense the type of learning or sense the types of inequalities and diversities that are represented through this learning is definitely restricted now. But I think that it is important to not only underline that, you know, empathy has to be a priority as an outcome of this learning, but to be proactive about maybe seeking the channels and the mediums to continue including these populations and these audiences.
I guess one thing is I kind of feel like we're maybe sounding as if Robin and I had the whole system of experiential and field-based learning licked before this, and that it was all worked out. And I don't think that's true. And I'm pretty sure Robin wouldn't try and suggest that that was true either. And the fact that field school learning was still hard, that it wasn't always authentic, that students did take shortcuts and ignore encounters with the other, and faculty member leaders did too, and there is a whole host of sort of intercultural challenges that we face, not to mention the challenges of just getting along together with a group of people who you didn't know a few weeks ago in an immersive and intensive environment. So I don't want to come off myself as sounding like I had a recipe or a formula for, you know, turning the city into a mirror through field school education, but the experiential dimension added to the reflective dimension, added to the necessity of social mixing, puts a responsibility and an opportunity for empathy onto learners, students and educators both, as well as humility, that we can't replicate in the classroom.
I'd be curious to hear also more about, or maybe you could briefly at least expand on this notion of risk and discomfort, you know, two notions that you seem to have embraced in your earlier comments, and that it is necessary to basically confront students with risk and with discomfort. And I wonder if you could tell a little more about how, as educators, you see these notions playing out, or and how you are required to regulate, or to what extent and how you want to regulate these notions, and maybe then on top of that, how do this taking discomfort and risk as a pillar of pedagogy, how does this relate to the current moment in which security and safety seem to be the imperative?
From my perspective, I see teaching students about urban sustainability and urban resilience as an exercise in teaching students complexity thinking and challenging myself to also allow more variables and more complexities and more feedback mechanisms, more trade-offs into my own way of seeing the city and seeing the options for making changes to it. And so really that my push towards that is risky. It's risky, particularly in the context of, you know what, we have an urban planning model. It's called modernism. It has existed since the dawn of planning as a profession and as an area of study. There are particular benefits that modernist planning model can point to in terms of adding to people's safety and physical health and security. The drawbacks of that model, planners have spent the past 20 years enumerating and articulating, but they fade into the background when a crisis like this one, but others in the past as well, hit, especially in the face of this sort of drive towards efficient responses. And that drive towards efficient responses also exists in students' educational choices, right? Because everybody's trying to make choices that are efficient for their learning, for their graduation, for their career development, for their ability to, you know, become that professional or that urban actor that they see as being valuable. But students don't necessarily know what they ought to be doing in life. And that's kind of what, to me, university learning should be about. It's about discovering new pathways and new modes of inquiry and new things to think about and study and do in the world that you didn't even know were possibilities before you started. So if all we're doing in teaching people about planning is teaching them a tried and true model that has particular efficiencies and is comfortable to impart to students, then we're certainly not allowing an opening of the city towards thinking differently and acting differently, which we need to do if we want to move towards urban resilience or urban sustainability. And I think that there was this sense before the pandemic hit that we were losing the battle towards more sustainable cities, more resilient cities. So there is a sense of hope that we might have an opening for changes in that direction. But my concern is that we are not going to advance, we're not going to move into that open space if we don't take risks, because it's not an efficient thing to do, right? If you're taking risks, that means that you will fail. There will be time lost, there will be effort lost, but that has to be privileged as the process of inquiry when we're trying to teach students to be leaders of effective urban social change.
Yeah, indeed. And this also is a great segue into this more meta level of thinking behind discomfort zones, in that we refer to the transformative learning principles from Mesro that go through basically nine phases in which personal and individual interactions and encounters allow for reflective processes, the redefinition of meaning for individuals, so that they can make better sense of the world, which is particularly important, especially as the world changes even more. We see that with COVID-19, with almost weekly or in some cases daily updates, changes to how we can interact or just be on the streets or must be at home. So in this sense, we do have to take this risk. I think if we want to be able to be confident in our abilities and our students' abilities as urbanists who have to grapple and in some way manage the uncertainty in the future. So while it might not make most complete sense now, there is the chance that taking this risk and being uncomfortable in this journey of looking at, okay, what we don't know now, but how we can maybe approach it, could provide a better way of dealing not only with COVID-19, but other greater normative or imperatives that we're dealing with, such as climate change or global inequity or something that we've been made even more extremely aware of, global production chains, the whole gamut.
Great, thank you very much, Robin and Meg, for reflecting this.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.